everyone, welcome back to the Deep Dive. You know how we do things here? We grab a juicy legal topic and really, I mean really, break it down.
That's right. No surface skimming here, we go deep.
Today's dive is going to be especially helpful for any of you out there knee-deep in law school, especially if you're wrestling with mergers and acquisitions. We're tackling a case straight from the Delaware Supreme Court, Corwin v. KKR Financial Holdings, LLC.
It's a big one, that's for sure.
This case gets to the heart of when a merger, even one that might raise some eyebrows, can get a free pass from the courts just because the stockholders voted for it.
It's all about stockholder approval and when it can basically shield a deal from intense judicial review.
So consider this your crash course, your cheat sheet to understanding a really pivotal concept in corporate law. Ready to jump in?
Absolutely. We're going to take apart this Corwin decision piece by piece. We'll look at the whole backstory, the legal fight at the center of it all, and the really important part, how it's changed the game for how mergers are looked at under the law and how much power a stockholder vote really has.
Yeah, that's the core of it, right? Like, what does it really mean when stockholders say yes to a deal?
Right. Our mission here is to figure out exactly when the business judgment rule, that idea that courts should generally defer to business decisions, comes into play after a stockholder vote.
So it's like, okay, the stockholders voted, but does that automatically mean the courts will back off and let the deal go through?
Exactly. And we want to understand why that matters so much for any mergers that happen in the future and for avoiding those nasty legal battles, you know, the litigation risks everyone wants to stay clear of. We're on the hunt for those aha moments, those key takeaways about control, how much power stockholders actually have, and what could potentially torpedo a merger, even if it looks like it's got the green light from the stockholders.
This is where it gets interesting, right? Because we all know those situations where things might look okay on the surface, but there's something lurking underneath.
Absolutely. So to set the scene, let's rewind back to 2011. You've got KKR & Co., the big private equity firm, and they decide they're going to acquire KKR Financial Holdings. You'll usually hear it called KFN for short.
Right, KFN. Keep it simple. So they structured this deal as a stock-for-stock swap, right?
Yep. For every share of KFN you had, you'd get 0.51 shares of KKR.
Now, initially, that sounds like a pretty sweet deal for the KFN stockholders. It represented a 35% premium compared to what their stock was trading for at the time.
On paper, it looked like a win. But as we know, things aren't always as they appear.
And that's where the context comes in. To really grasp why this ended up in court, we need to understand what KFN actually did.
You got it. KFN's primary business was actually pretty specialized. They were all about financing KKR's leveraged buyouts. Think of it like this. They were the financial engine behind KKR's big deals.
So from the get-go, there was already this close, intertwined relationship between KKR and KFN. They weren't strangers to each other by any stretch.
No. Not at all. And this pre-existing relationship is what adds a whole layer of complexity to the story. It's not your typical merger scenario.
Right, it throws in a curveball. Because KFN didn't operate like most companies with their own internal management team.
Instead, they relied on a management agreement with another company called, wait for it, KKR Financial Advisors.
Now that name probably rings a bell. It's not a coincidence. KKR Financial Advisors was an affiliate of, you guessed it, KKR.
So you can see how the lines start to blur a bit, right?
Yeah. And here's where things get even stickier. This management agreement had a particular clause, a termination clause, that said if KFN wanted to end the agreement, they would have to pay a fee. And guess what? This seemingly innocuous clause became the focal point of the legal challenge that followed.
That's interesting. So it wasn't the merger itself that triggered the lawsuit, but this specific detail within a pre-existing agreement.
Precisely. And that brings up a really important question. Why did some of the KFN stockholders decide to sue in the first place?
Yeah. What was it about this deal, even with that appealing premium, that raised red flags for them? What were they worried about?
The stockholders who filed that lawsuit argued that the management agreement essentially gave KKR too much power.
Too much power? Like how?
Like they were the ones calling the shots at KFN, even though it wasn't officially their company.
Kind of like pulling strings from behind the curtain?
That's a good way to put it. Their claim was that KKR was acting as a de facto controlling stockholder of KFN. Now, this is important because when a company is controlled by a single stockholder, any deal they make with that company, like a merger, gets a much harsher look from the courts.
So it's not just a friendly review anymore?
Not at all. It triggers a totally different standard of review called entire fairness.
Entire fairness. That sounds pretty serious.
It is. And that's what landed this whole case right in the lap of the Delaware Supreme Court. So we've got this merger that most of the stockholders voted for. But there's this argument that one of the parties, KKR, might have had a bit too much sway, even if they didn't officially control KFN. And that raises a huge legal question.
So the question is, when does the business judgment rule, that typical hands-off approach that courts take with business decisions, still apply?
Even when there's this shadow of potential control hanging over the deal.
Exactly. That's the crux of the legal battle in Corwin.
And the Delaware Supreme Court stepped in to settle the score.
And what did they decide?
Their decision was pretty decisive. They said, no, KKR was not a controlling stockholder of KFN, legally speaking. And the reasons behind their conclusion, those are the golden nuggets that help us understand the real meat of this case.
Okay, so what were those key reasons? Why did the court come down so definitively on the side of saying KKR wasn't calling the shots?
Well, the court highlighted a few important facts. Number one, KKR owned less than 1% of KFN's stock. That's not exactly a controlling stake, right?
It's hard to argue you're in control when you own such a tiny slice of the pie.
Exactly. Number two, KKR had absolutely zero legal right to appoint anyone to the KFN board of directors.
So they couldn't handpick the people making decisions?
Nope. They had no formal say in who sat on that board. And number three, this is a big one, KKR didn't have any contractual veto power over decisions made by the KFN board.
So even if they didn't like what the board was doing, they couldn't just step in and say, nope, not happening.
Exactly. The court drew a very sharp line in the sand here. They said, look, just because you have a contract for services like this management agreement, that doesn't magically turn into legal control over the whole company. Influence, maybe? Control? No.
So they're emphasizing that formal control, like owning a lot of stock or having the power to appoint board members. That's what really matters in the eyes of the law.
You got it. It's about those formal levers of power, not just the ability to exert some influence behind the scenes.
So if we take a step back and think about this in the big picture of corporate law, what the court is saying is you can have a really significant business relationship with another company, but that doesn't mean you legally control them.
It's a really important distinction.
So the court decided KKR wasn't in control. That means the merger got the okay from the stockholders, no coercion, everyone had all the information they needed. So where did that leave them?
Well, it led them straight to the business judgment rule. The Delaware Supreme Court said, since KKR isn't a controlling stockholder and the stockholder vote was clean, the business judgment rule is the right standard to use here.
So back to that hands-off approach we were talking about.
Exactly. And this ruling, it's actually so important that it's become its own thing in corporate law. We call it the Corwin Doctrine.
Catchy name.
It basically means if a merger gets the blessing of disinterested and informed stockholders, courts will generally assume the directors did their job and made a reasonable decision.
Less scrutiny from the courts. That's got to be a relief for companies considering mergers.
Big relief. But it's not a total free-for-all. The Corwin Doctrine doesn't cover situations where there was fraud involved or if companies hid important information from stockholders before the vote.
So honesty and transparency are still key.
Absolutely. Now, remember those two standards of review we talked about earlier? Entire fairness and the business judgment rule.
Yeah, the microscope versus the hands-off approach.
Those are crucial for understanding the real impact of Corwin. So let's break those down a bit more, because the difference between them can completely change the outcome of a legal challenge to a merger.
Okay, so first up, entire fairness.
Yeah.
When does that come into play and why is it such a big deal?
Entire fairness is like the most intense scrutiny a court can give a business deal. It's like they're examining every single detail under a magnifying glass.
No stone unturned.
Exactly. And when this standard applies, the burden of proof is completely on the shoulders of the defendants. That usually means the company's directors and officers. They have to prove that the deal was completely fair to all stockholders, especially the minority stockholders who might not have as much say.
So they have to prove it was fair in terms of the price those stockholders got and in terms of the whole process of how the deal was put together.
You got it. They have to show that everything was done by the book, above board, no funny business.
It sounds like it's pretty tough to pass the entire fairness test.
It is. It's a very high bar. Now let's flip the script and look at the business judgment rule.
Which is much more relaxed, right?
Way more relaxed. The business judgment rule basically starts with the assumption that the company's directors did everything right. They acted in good faith, they were informed, and they genuinely believed they were doing what was best for the company and all the stockholders.
It's like giving them the benefit of the doubt.
Exactly. And under this rule, the burden of proof shifts to the plaintiffs, the stockholders who are trying to block the deal. They have to prove that the directors messed up somehow.
So they have to prove things like the directors were reckless, or they acted fraudulently, or they put their own personal interests ahead of the company's.
That's right. And proving that kind of stuff is much, much harder than simply showing that a deal might not have been the absolute best deal possible. It's a totally different legal playing field.
So yeah, I can see why companies breathe a sigh of relief when the business judgment rule applies.
It's a game changer. Now let's circle back to this whole idea of a controlling stockholder, because that's a recurring theme here.
It is, and it's kind of a tricky concept to pin down. So after Corwin, how does Delaware law actually define whether a stockholder has that level of control?
The court in Corwin was very clear about one thing. Proving that someone is a controlling stockholder requires showing that they actually, I mean really actually, control how the company operates. It's not enough to just have influence. You need real, tangible power.
So it's not just about whispering in someone's ear.
Nope. It's about having the authority to actually make things happen. And that usually boils down to a couple of things.
Like what?
Well, the most obvious one is owning a majority of the company's voting stock. If you have enough votes to dictate who gets elected to the board, that's pretty strong evidence of control, right?
It's hard to argue with that.
Another big one is having the power to actually appoint or remove members of the board of directors. If you can control who sits at the table making decisions, you're effectively in control of the company.
So it's about those formal mechanisms, like the voting power that comes with owning a majority of the shares, or the power to directly choose the board members.
Exactly. And remember, Corwin made it clear that simply having a contract with a company, even a management agreement like in this case, that's not enough to establish legal control.
It's got to be more than just a business relationship. It's got to be about who actually holds the reins of power.
Right, right. Think about it like this. It's less about being the puppet master pulling strings from behind the scenes, and more about actually owning and operating the puppet.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, the court was pretty firm in rejecting the argument that the management agreement gave KKR control over KFN. Can we dig into the specifics of their reasoning there? What nuances were they pointing out?
Sure. The court looked at the management agreement and acknowledged that, yeah, it could give KKR some influence over how KFN operated. But they were also very clear that KFN's board of directors, they still had their legal independence. They still had the final say on making important decisions for the company.
Even if it meant paying a termination fee to break free from that management agreement.
Even then, they weren't just puppets following KKR's orders. They had their own legal authority and responsibility to act in the best interests of KFN and its stockholders.
Interesting. So the court was basically saying, look, KFN's board, they might have had to consider the cost of ending that management agreement, but they still had the power to make those decisions.
That's right. They were still in the driver's seat, even if there were some costs associated with changing direction. And the court really emphasized that when it comes to determining control under Delaware law, owning stock, and having those formal governance rights, like the power to elect or remove directors, those are far more important than just having a contract for services.
So having a contract doesn't automatically equate to control. It's got to be about those more formal structural aspects of corporate governance.
Precisely. Now, this decision from the Delaware Supreme Court, it wasn't just about the specifics of this one case. It was also about setting a precedent, a kind of guiding principle for how future mergers should be reviewed.
So it's not just about KKR and KFN. It's about the big picture of how mergers are handled under the law.
Absolutely. And the driving force behind their decision, the underlying policy rationale, was all about respecting the choices made by informed stockholders.
Okay, unpack that for me a bit.
Yeah. The Delaware courts, they strongly believe that stockholders are generally the best people to decide whether a deal is good or bad for their investment. They're the ones with skin in the game. And unless there's something seriously wrong with how that stockholder vote happened, like if people were forced to vote a certain way or if they weren't given all the information they needed, the courts are very hesitant to step in and second guess that collective decision made by the stockholders.
So it's like, let the stockholders decide. And unless something shady happened, we're going to respect their judgment.
Exactly. And the court actually said it pretty bluntly in their decision. They said Delaware law is very, very reluctant to second guess the judgment of an informed, disinterested majority of stockholders when those stockholders are making decisions about their own economic self-interest. It's about giving those stockholders the power to make those decisions.
Powerful stuff. So what's the legacy of Corwin? How has it actually played out in the world of mergers and acquisitions since this decision came down? And what are the big lessons here for our listener who's still in the thick of learning all this stuff in law school?
Well, Corwin has had a huge impact. In general, it's made it a lot harder to challenge a merger in court if that merger got the approval of informed stockholders. And that's been a major win for companies and their lawyers who work on these kinds of deals.
So it's like a shield against those lawsuits that can pop up after a merger is finalized.
Exactly. If you're a lawyer putting a merger together and you can make sure the stockholder vote is clean, everyone's informed, no one's being pressured, you're in a much better position to defend that deal if someone tries to sue later on. Corwin basically says, if the stockholders said yes and they knew what they were doing, we're not going to undo that deal.
It's like a legal safety net.
And that brings us to another big takeaway, especially after Corwin: transparency. Companies really can't afford to hide information or be sneaky with the stuff they give to stockholders before a vote.
Because if they do, they could lose that protection from the business judgment rule, even if they get the stockholder approval.
That's the risk. The whole idea behind Corwin, that deference to an informed stockholder vote, it falls apart. If there's important information missing or if things have been misrepresented, the court was very clear about that.
So, lesson one for our future lawyer out there. Full disclosure, all the cards on the table, no funny business.
Right. And the second lesson, this one's super important too. Really understanding what control means under Delaware law. It's not just about having some influence. It's about having that real, tangible power over the company.
And Corwin made it clear that a contract alone, like that management agreement, doesn't equal control.
Exactly. Now, remember that quote we mentioned earlier, the one from the Corwin decision, where the court said, when disinterested stockholders make a mature decision about their own economic self-interest, judicial second-guessing is almost completely off the table.
Yeah, that's a powerful statement.
It really sums up the whole message of Corwin. Stockholder approval, when it's done right, carries a lot of weight, and the courts will generally respect that.
So let's recap. The core message of Corwin is this. When there's no controlling stockholder involved, the disinterested stockholders get all the information they need, and they freely choose to approve the merger, the courts are going to step back and let that decision stand.
That's the essence of it. And for our listener, as you keep learning about the world of corporate law, remember that understanding those nuances of control, knowing how crucial it is for stockholders to have all the information, and recognizing the power that stockholders have to approve or reject a deal, those are all fundamental concepts that you'll see again and again.
So, Corwin, it's not just a case. It's a cornerstone of how we think about mergers and the power of stockholder votes.
It really is. And that brings us to our final thought for today, something for you all to chew on as you keep exploring this fascinating world of corporate law.
Here's the question. Corwin definitely gives stockholders more power in a lot of merger situations, and it can help cut down on those drawn-out legal battles. But does it go far enough?
That's the big question, isn't it?
Does it fully address the potential for companies, even if they don't technically control another company, to use their influence to push through deals that might not be in the best interests of all the stockholders, especially those minority stockholders who might not have as much say?
So it's like, even without formal control, is there still a risk that some players might have too much sway? And is relying solely on the idea of an informed vote really enough to protect everyone involved?
It's a tricky balance to strike. You want to empower stockholders, but you also want to make sure no one is taking advantage of the system.
It's something to think about. Maybe there's more to the story, more layers to peel back.
Definitely. And that's what makes corporate law so interesting. There's always more to learn, more to explore.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into Corwin. We'll be back soon with another fascinating case, ready to break it all down for you.
Until then, keep those legal minds sharp.
See you next time.